Changes next. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Ten years ago this month, President Bush signed a sweeping public education reform law called No Child Left Behind.
Our schools will have higher expectations. We believe every child can learn. Our schools will have greater resources to help meet those goals. Parents will have more information about the schools and more say in how their children are educated. From this day forward, all students will have a better chance to learn, to excel, and to live out their dreams.
Bush was flanked by a powerful bipartisan group of lawmakers, from Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy to Republican Congressman John Boehner. But the warm feelings for No Child Left Behind inside the Beltway gave way to chillier sentiment once it hit the states. Many local school districts saw the law as a huge new federal mandate involving mounds of paperwork, unrealistic expectations, and draconian punishments for schools deemed failing. Over the years, some states tried to work with the law, others worked around it, and by late in the decade, when Barack Obama became president on a campaign of change, one of those changes he promised was to NCLB. Late last year, the administration told states they could opt out of the law, and many, including New Hampshire, were quick to take that offer. But now, 10 years later, some analysts are saying NCLB got a bad rap, that while districts may have struggled to comply, the law's tough system of standards, accountability, and consequences are still desperately needed. Today in The Exchange, we grade No Child Left Behind, and let's hear from you. Were you working in public education or a student in public schools during the time of No Child Left Behind? How do you feel it has affected education? Has it helped or hurt? And if you think NCLB has run its course, what should replace it? Should the federal government have some control over standards, or should it all be conducted locally? Give us a call, The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. We had three people joining us this hour who've looked at this issue for a long time. From D.C., Mary Kusler, Director of Government Relations for the National Education Association, the Educators Union. And Mary, nice to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, Laura.
Also joining us from Washington, Allison Klein, reporter for Education Week, co-author of the blog Politics K-12. And Allison, welcome back to The Exchange, and thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us from Texas, Sandy Kress, one of the original architects of No Child Left Behind under the Bush administration. And Sandy, thank you also for being with us.
Good to be with you, Laura.
Well, and Sandy, you first. What was the thinking behind No Child Left Behind and why this was needed? As I said, you were there at the beginning.
Well, what drew President Bush together with Senator Kennedy, which is in itself something to remember fondly, Senator Gregg from New Hampshire, along with Senator Kennedy, Congressman Miller, John Boehner, in a tremendous bipartisan effort, 80% of all, just imagine today, 80% of Democrats and 80% of Republicans agreeing on something in both houses. What drew them together was a concern that the disadvantaged youngsters that the federal government had sought to help beginning in the 60s were just simply not making the progress they needed to make in terms of reading and math proficiency, and that these dollars, these federal dollars, needed to be used more effectively to diagnose and to show how that these subgroups, these disadvantaged populations, were doing, and create pressure, pressure that's not necessarily wanted all the time, but pressure and tools to improve. We had noticed in several states that had begun to develop standards, testing, and consequences, three states in 93, a majority of states by 1999, that they were making progress. So No Child Left Behind essentially was an emphasis on standards, testing, and consequences, and resources, so that the other states could join in the progress these pioneer states had made. I know we'll talk about it during the program, but tremendous progress has been made in the wake of that. But that's what brought this bipartisan coalition together.
So an idea that the federal government is funneling out money to local schools and a clear, data-driven set of standards, consequences, expectations that the schools had to meet in order to get this federal money. Is that right, Sandy?
Correct. That's exactly right.
Well, Allison, as you well know, you know, once it hit the local level, some schools said, whoa, what's going on here? How big a shift was this for local schools in terms of federal government involvement?
Sure. Well, in the past, the federal government had sort of a previous reauthorization of what's known as the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. That's the law that came back from 1965, as you heard Sandy say, that sort of underlies No Child Left Behind. There was some, you know, federal involvement required, some federal accountability, but this was the biggest shift, really, I would say, probably since the federal government started, giving aid for disadvantaged kids. For the first time, states were required to test students in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school. They had to test every student in reading and math, so that really, that effect was really felt in the classroom. There was also, you know, sort of a new system of federally mandated sanctions, things that would happen in schools that weren't meeting the law's achievement targets. Schools had to allow students to use school choice. They had to allow students to get free tutoring if the school wasn't meeting achievement targets. And then the sanctions, you know, as, you know, the years went by and if a school wasn't improving, the sanctions became greater, you know, schools were supposed to close, things like that. So, you know, it was for the first time sort of every teacher in every school felt like they, like this new pressure to perform well in a new accountability system.
And I remember a lot of schools were terrified of these sanctions, you know, the firing of staff, the closing of schools. But how often did that really happen, Allison?
You know, not as often as folks thought when the law was first passed. There were there's sort of a list of possible options for schools that are not doing well under the law, and one of the options is other. And for the most part, most schools have chosen to go with the other option, which might mean they send in an improvement team, something like that. Until the Obama administration came in, and they changed some of those prescriptions, they actually have been much more specific about what they want to see schools do. We hadn't seen very many schools get rid of staff or close.
Well, and we'll definitely talk about how the Obama administration, under Secretary Duncan, has made big changes to this law. But Mary, to you first, just going back, you know, 10 years ago, right at the outset, teachers had concerns about No Child Left Behind. What were they?
Absolutely. Well, I think, first of all, I think we need to talk about and raise a point that Sandy raised, which was one of the best things that did come out of the law, and that is this term disaggregation. And what essentially that means is we are looking at different subgroups of students based along racial, poverty, and in some cases gender lines, and comparing their performance to the school as a whole and to each other. And this was an important development in the role of the federal government, shining light on the data at the local level and as Sandy said, beginning to create that pressure. Where we feel that it went awry in all of this is that traditionally, as per the 10th Amendment of our U.S. Constitution, education has always been a state's right. The federal government has always been a minority player in this because they're only at most providing 8% of the funding. Where No Child Left Behind took a large departure from that is they were now providing only 8% of the funding, but dictating about 80% of what was happening at the local level. And so there was a mismatch between what the federal government was requiring and what the federal government was paying for. In addition, there was an increased emphasis on math and reading, and what we've seen combined between the implementation of the law and the unfortunate trend in education funding due to the recession is we've seen an overemphasis on math and reading instruction with a narrowing of the curriculum. So we're no longer educating the whole child. Instead, we're really all focusing on the math and reading and losing what has often given American an edge internationally of creating, of developing creative thinkers who have a wealth of knowledge in many areas, not just in math and reading. While that's important, we need to also recognize there are other areas we should be focusing on.
Well, and that's been a critique that we've heard from teachers here in New Hampshire all along. But something else you said I want to ask you about, Mary. You said that the federal government only provides 8% of school funding, but with NCLB, No Child Left Behind, it was imposing 80% of the requirements on local schools. If this thing had been fully funded, in your opinion, would it have been so troublesome? I mean, is the money really the big thing here?
I don't think the money is the big thing. I think it's certainly part of it. But I don't believe that the federal government was ever going to fully fund all of the requirements that they were putting into the law, especially given the fact that one of the unique factors of the American public education system is we have a large variety of schools, everything from large urban city school districts to small rural school districts up in the North Country of New Hampshire. And that implementing a series of requirements on schools as if they are all the same was a really unfair advantage, especially to the smallest and most rural of schools that didn't have the same capacity as some of the urban schools in terms of administrative staff or just instructional staff, as well as community support, other things that vary so much from school to school. There just became a certain level of bureaucracy that was added in, a one-size-fits-all nature, and treating everyone the same in regards to their expectations, but also when they were identified, which I'm sure we'll get to later, not really having the resources to treat everyone with the added assistance that was needed to help improve the struggling schools.
Well, and after a short break, we will definitely address some of those issues, including the one-size-fits-all. That's a complaint that often comes up, including the emphasis also on math and reading, that narrowed the curriculum. I've got an email from a longtime elementary school teacher who wants to talk about that. After a break, we'll also take your calls at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the Exchange, we're looking back 10 years later at No Child Left Behind. And we want to hear from you. If you were working in public education over the last decade or a student in public schools during this time of No Child Left Behind, how would you gauge its impact given your experience? And what do you think about the broader questions this raises? Should the federal government have some say over school standards, or should it all be determined locally? We'll take your thoughts, questions, comments at 1-800-892-6477, and we'll be right back.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Waste Management, with a reminder to save energy by turning off unnecessary lights and recycle CFL bulbs properly when they burn out. Details at thinkgreenfromhome.com. And from Absolute Resource Associates, providing environmental services to address concerns such as mold, asbestos, lead, and indoor air and water quality, absoluteresourceassociates.com. More on No Child Left Behind 10 years later on The Exchange on NHPR and at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, the impact of the Keystone Pipeline decision. New Hampshire weather today, clouding up, highs from 15 in the North Country, 20 to 25 in central New Hampshire and near 30 in southern New Hampshire. Tonight, cloudy with some light snow likely ending by morning. Accumulations of 1 to 3 inches possible. Lows tonight from 10 in the North Country ranging to 20 in southern New Hampshire. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. As the landmark education law known as No Child Left Behind turns 10 this month, we're looking at its impact on our education system. And let's hear from you. How do you think No Child Left Behind has affected your local schools? Has it been for the better or for the worse? And if you think NCLB has run its course, what should replace it, if anything? Join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook. We hope you'll go to our page and join the conversation there. And Sandy Kress, again, one of the original architects of No Child Left Behind under the Bush administration. Let's address some of the things that Mary said, and I'd like to do that through an email I received this morning from Steve. He says, I've been an elementary teacher for 36 years. He says, vital curriculum areas such as writing, thinking, science, social studies have been put on the back burner while we've been concentrating on improving test scores and reading and math. He says, instead of spending quality time for planning challenging and engaging lessons, teachers use up that time constantly assessing their students' progress, poring over data, and filling in paperwork about the results. Steve concludes, he says, No Child Left Behind has had a negative effect on education in New Hampshire. What do you think, Sandy, this focus on math and reading at the expense of everything else?
Well, let me say two things. I've heard this before from Steve, and Mary gave voice to it. What they're saying may be true in certain instances, but it just doesn't square with the facts across the country. And I encourage all your listeners, and Mary, too, for that matter, to go to the National Center of Education Statistics, a group in Washington associated with the Department of Education that collects data from all the schools across the country. And they've been measuring the amount of time in our schools devoted to various subjects. And you can look and see before No Child Left Behind and now today how much time is devoted to these various subjects. And here's the basic finding. Number one, we spend more time on instruction generally today than we did before. And number two, three points. Number two, we do spend more time on math and reading, but we also spend more time on science and social studies and these other areas. This is true in high school. It's true in elementary school. So this is a myth. It's just simply not true. Now, the second point I'd make with respect to the time we spend on math and reading, if our young people cannot read and cannot read proficiently, they're not likely to do well in poetry, in art history, in science, because they cannot, or in math for that matter, because they can't understand the material they're learning. So it's important that they read successfully. Now, this point about 80% of the time is spent, there's no evidence for this, and there's no reason for schools or districts to spend 80% of their time, anywhere near 80%. What does No Child Left Behind require? It requires that youngsters be tested once, one time, not all year, not prep tests, not all kinds of tests during the year. One time, usually it's about an hour test of about 30 or 40 questions, just to be sure that they understand the vocabulary, that they can read and comprehend, that they can do the math that's associated with their grade level. That requirement is in place. The second thing that's in place is that where youngsters are doing poorly against state standards, these standards are not set by the federal government, the tests are not made by the federal government, the ratings and the accountability systems are determined by the states. We talk about the 10th Amendment. All No Child Left Behind says is that in return for the 8% of the money, the federal money, that they will be measured and that there will be some consequence locally determined. That's what the law says, locally determined by the local school district within a range of choices. To do something for those youngsters who are not even proficient to the state standard. So I don't know where, and those are locally determined decisions. So this, it's just absolutely mythical and untrue that 80% of what has to happen in education is determined by the federal government.
What about this one-size-fits-all then, Sandy? You seem to be addressing that was the frequent complaint that we heard over the 10 years. This is a one-size-fits-all top-down from Washington. You're saying not so. It was largely conducted by the states.
Well, you know, again, you know, it's interesting. No Child Left Behind gets beaten up on both sides.
Yeah, conservatives and liberals don't like it.
The other side, which No Child Left Behind has been getting beaten up by the Obama administration and by the standards movement for not being prescriptive enough. Because the truth is the standards vary across the states. There's no one size fits all on the standards, and No Child Left Behind is getting beaten up by people who complain about that. The tests are not one size fits all. There are multiple tests across districts and states. The consequences are not one size fits all. What a school does if an African American youngster or a Hispanic youngster is reading poorly, No Child Left Behind does not tell the teacher or the school what to do to repair or intervene. Those are decisions that are made by teachers and they're made by the school. Now, there is this notion of school improvement, corrective action, something more serious has to happen. But the array of choices about what to do in particular when these students are not performing at the proficient level are numerous, diverse, and multiple. There's no notion at all of one size fits all. The one size fits all idea behind No Child Left Behind is simply that if an African-American youngster or a Hispanic youngster or a low-income youngster or a student with disability is not reading at grade level, not proficient on the state assessment, something needs to be done.
Well, let me ask
and
Mary.
I think that's an expectation that ought to be true in a rural area in New Hampshire or in an urban area in New York.
Mary,
that's an expectation we ought to have all across the country.
And real quick to you, Mary, and then I do want to go to our callers as well. What do you think about this idea that, you know, if you don't like the standards, which Sandy says were set by the states, what is the alternative toward addressing the severe problems that No Child Left Behind did try to address, that some kids were really, truly being left behind? I mean, it's one thing to say, I don't like this, but what's your alternative?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I think I need to disagree with Sandy that things about the array of choices, because for schools that are deemed in need of improvement by the arbitrary system that was set up, they are required to spend 20% of a certain pot of money they get for disadvantaged youth on public school choice and supplemental services for those students. They have no choice in that matter. They are dictated those particular prescriptions from the federal government, and those particular prescriptions have been shown to be A, not effective when compared to other interventions for students who are most in need, and B, not being used because they are not the real options that parents are looking for their children in the education system. Instead, the way the system should be set up is to be investing in what it takes to build the foundation for student learning, such as early childhood education, smaller class sizes, and making sure that we have up-to-date materials as well as a more diverse curriculum so that our students are able to compete internationally. So I just do not agree with the picture that Sandy has painted, that there is all this choice in the matter and a variety of options available for schools at the local level, because the way that the law was written, that is not actually the case.
Well, let's go to our callers. And Allison Klein, I haven't forgotten about you, too, but I want to take a couple calls, and then we'll talk some more about this idea. Our number here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we look back at 10 years of the federal education reform law known as No Child Left Behind. We'd like your grade for NCLB. Has it been good for our local public schools here in New Hampshire or not? 1-800-892-6477. And Perry's up first, waiting in Hudson. Hi, Perry. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead.
I actually was a student during No Child Left as well. I was in eighth grade in 2002, so I was basically in school as it started. And my question is related to when I was in school, I remember many times, both in class during, you know, conversations and whatnot in public and in private, talking to teachers about No Child Left Behind, and there was a definite like negative sense across the board. And I had some very bright and committed teachers when I was in school, and I just found it odd that, you know, there was this big bill, and the sense was that there was this big thing that wasn't, you know, no input was given by educational experts and people. And it was a big, like, oh, this is the government doing this. And I was just curious if there was any, like, educational insight and how much support did this get from teachers across the board.
Perry, thanks a lot for calling in, and good to hear from you since you were in eighth grade exactly when this whole thing got started. Allison, can you take us back? I mean, how did this get started and how much input was there from those on the ground, the educators?
Well, I think... I actually may just turn this back question over to Mary and Sandy because they were there at the
right
outset, and I was covering other issues. But certainly that's been a perennial complaint of, you know, not just teachers but also school administrators who say, hey, you know, we weren't in the room when this law was being crafted.
Why, though, Allison, this back and forth that we heard from Mary and Sandy and that we've heard over the past 10 years, this back and forth about how much dictation from the federal government was put on schools, how intrusive it really was, how much it really was locally controlled. Why the vast differences in worldview here?
Well, I think it sort of depends on, you know, your perspective. If you're a teacher in a classroom and you didn't have to, you know, test students every year in math and reading, you know, it seems like a big federal dictation. If you're a lawmaker in Washington and you're sending out checks to states and you're not sure if students are learning, you feel like that's a fair trade. So it really just depends on where you sit.
And Sandy, to you again, how much did local educators have input into this law?
Well, let's remember that this law was 3 years in the making, 2 years at the end of the Clinton administration, and the first full year of the Bush administration. Let's also remember that these Democrats, who not only signed on to the law, but led the way in getting it passed, were people, and I want to especially focus on Senator Kennedy, who was the chairman of the Senate Education Committee when this bill went through, who ran everybody through the process and gave everybody a chance to participate. I don't think there's anyone in the history of lawmaking, and I worked with him and am grateful for the chance to have had to do that, and I think President Bush was as well. Senator Kennedy, there's no legislator who did more to make sure everyone's voice was heard. The AFT, the NEA, all the players, you know, had to go through, had tremendous opportunity to participate in this. In fact, the debate on the Senate floor, there was more time devoted to No Child Left Behind debate than any legislation since the civil rights legislation of the 60s. So there was a tremendous opportunity for input. There was opportunity for input from the various civil rights groups, too, who were concerned about not having these opportunities to have a better schools, or if the schools didn't improve, having certain choices, such as the one Mary talks about, that comes into play when a student is stuck in a school that is performing poorly for three or four straight years. And so it's not been used as much and sometimes not as effectively, but those people wanted to have an opportunity to have a say. And, of course, since No Child Left Behind was put in place and the accountability systems in the states that came before, and I hope we'll spend some time on that during the call because ultimately the effectiveness of policies is how well students do. African-American, Hispanic students, low-income students, students with disabilities are now performing at 1, 2, 2.5 grade levels ahead of where they were before this accountability movement got started. So it's worked, and I hope that we'll spend some time on that as well.
Mary, your quick thoughts, and then back to our callers again. You know, was there input from educators? Sandy says, look, we had a full vetting of this thing.
Absolutely. Well, I think that there's a certain element of truth because there has never been a longer time on the Senate floor for consideration of a piece of legislation since the civil rights legislation. But I think it's important to note that that passed the Senate in July of 2001. And shortly thereafter, if we all remember our Schoolhouse Rocks, how a bill becomes a law, the House and Senate went behind closed doors from about August through November. And that is when all the true negotiation happened between those working on the bill in the Senate, those working on the bill in the House, Sandy and those others working on it from the administration's perspective. And during that four-month period, no information was shared, no external input was given, and all of the wheeling and dealing really happened during those 4 months, and that was what crafted the final bill. And so at the end of the day, educators, community members, civil rights organizations were really shut out of the final process due to the way that it happened over those last 4 months of negotiation. We were given a bill in November. 48 hours later, it was over 800 pages of legislation. 48 hours later, it was offered for a vote by the full House of Representatives. There was absolutely no time to vet that bill, run it by local constituencies, look at potential impact of how this would really impact the education of students in classrooms across America, because they were rushing it through the process at the end to get this done. And in the end, really, the people who matter the most, the people who are on the ground implementing this, were left out.
How do you feel, real quickly, Mary, about the numbers that Sandy gives us? And I've seen these repeated elsewhere, that since No Child Left Behind, those students who were typically left behind, minority students, poor students, students with disabilities, are doing better in school.
Well, I think we can talk about the fact, what I said, mentioned earlier in the program today, which is one of the best things that came out of the law, and I think this is universally accepted, was the fact that we focused on individual subgroups of students and had that light shone upon it. Where I think it's really not fair is where we've really stepped away from our individual responsibility to certain students. While we've focused on the need to serve all children, we've lost that there are different ways that individual students learn, and I think students with disabilities are a great example. They have a really tough time under this law because we have one federal law, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which says that we shall treat all students with a disability as an individual. And then we have No Child Left Behind, which lumps them all together in the same category and assumes we're going to be assessing them in the same way and doesn't really allow the individual focus on their education to come through.
Let's take a call, and Mark is joining us from Hillsboro. Hi, Mark. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Good morning. I have to say that everybody is truly going about this the wrong way, and I say this because I've had 13 years of teaching experience, 3 years of administrative experience, and what the focus is, and when they talk about the consequences and when they talk about schools need to improve, you know, or else, I kind of laugh at the consequences because it's set up, you have choices, but those choices are, well, you can cut off your foot, you can cut off your leg, or you can cut off your neck, but you're going to have to pick one of those. And in many ways, that's just not fair. The piece that's really missing is the fact that we're not focusing on the kids being active, engaged, and interested learners. You can have the best school in the world. You can have everything that the state wants, everything that the federal government wants. You can have class sizes of six. And if you have students that are not interested in what's going on in the four walls of the school, they are not going to learn.
But what does No Child Left Behind have to do with that, Mark?
Well, No Child Left Behind, it basically said that, you know, everybody needs to succeed. And that's the main problem with the No Child Left Behind is when you force or when you make the expectation that everybody is going to succeed, while, yes, some of your lower-level learners do begin to succeed, your top-end learners are drugged down, to the masses and to, in many cases, those lower-level learner.
I see, yes, and we've heard this complaint also over the years in the many programs we've done. So we'll address it after a break, Mark, so stay tuned. We'll be right back after a short break.
Hi, I'm Doug Cole, president of Cole Gardens in Concord, New Hampshire. Oh, it's great on a busy day at the Garden Center. We'll hear a lot of our customers say, hey, I heard you on NHPR. You know, it's just good to know that our word is getting out and they're hearing it. Yeah, we highly recommend other businesses to underwrite NHPR. We know the word gets out and we know it's a benefit.
To learn more about underwriting, visit the support page on nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the Grand Family State Motors Lincoln, offering a selection of green-friendly luxury crossovers and sports sedans rated up to 41 mpg city. State Motors North Manchester, statemotors.com. And from Goodwill Industries of Northern New England, offering youth in Greater Portsmouth employment and educational support. Learn more at goodwillnne.org/youth. Good morning, it's 9:40, and this is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we talk with Gary Hirschberg, departing CEO of Stonyfield Farm Yogurt, about his plans for the future. Email us your questions for Gary Hirschberg at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today, it's a retrospective on 10 years of the education reform law known as No Child Left Behind. Join us with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Were you working in public education or a student in public schools during the time of NCLB over the last 10 years? How would you gauge its impact given your experience? And what do you think? Should the federal government have some say over school standards, or should these be determined and carried out locally? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, just before the break, we heard from Mark, who said, we're going about this the wrong way. He had a number of critiques of No Child Left Behind. One of them, Allison, is one that we have heard a lot over the years, and that is that this law drags the students who operate at high levels, who are able to achieve more, perhaps, it drags them down to what he called the lowest common denominator. How often have you heard that concern in your reporting, Allison?
All the time.
Really?
You certainly hear that No Child Left Behind basically tried to get everybody kind of over a certain bar, over a certain hurdle, and it didn't, and that meant that schools focused on what folks call in ed policy the bubble kids, which were the kids who were sort of really close to meeting that standard, and they sort of ignored the kids who were kind of at the very bottom and unlikely to get over that hurdle, and also the kids who were just clearing it without a problem. So, you know, you hear a lot of concerns about leaving gifted children behind. This is actually probably an area where I think you may hear some agreement between Mary and Sandy. Certainly, Secretary of Education Margaret Spellings, who was, you know, worked with Sandy to craft the law when she became Secretary of Education. She allowed states to use what's known as a growth model to sort of do a better job of capturing kind of an individual student's progress over time. It's kind of a wonky term for, you know, measuring how a particular student would do. And that sort of, you know, that change kind of worked to get at that criticism. And I don't know if Mary and Sandy would agree on how well that worked.
Well, and here in New Hampshire, we called it Follow the Child, and our former education commissioner, Shirley, did approach it that way. You know, you mentioned Margaret Spellings, and Mary, just want to ask you about this. Ms. Spellings wrote an editorial on the 10th anniversary of No Child Left Behind, and here's what she said. She said, there's no excuse to retreat from the fundamental principle of educating all children to read on grade level. She even called it morally indefensible to set aside these standards, tacitly accepting that some kids are incapable of learning. Wow, I mean, a big statement there. What do you think, Mary? If you get rid of No Child Left Behind, are you tacitly saying, yeah, these kids can't learn, and let's just not focus on them?
Well, I think nobody at this point is really talking about getting rid of No Child Left Behind on a whole scale matter. I mean, it's about what is the next iteration of this law, of which policymakers on both sides of the aisle agree there needs to be drastic changes. I think that the one thing that we've seen out of the ESEA reauthorizations over the years is a progression in the increasing the quality of the standards movement. As Sandy said, this has been state and locally driven, which is great, and we have a new set of standards that are going around the states right now that are being state-driven called the Common Core Standards, which are really looking to increase, specifically in the areas where they started, math and reading, college and career-ready standards for all students. And so I would agree there is no excuse to retreat, and the fact that we do need to make sure that all students are learning. But the reality is, I think the debate comes at the federal level of what is the federal government's responsibility in all of that. And from our perspective, it is focusing on students and ensuring equity for the students who need the most assistance. And this is where we feel that No Child Left Behind went awry. We need to make sure that the next iteration of this law gets it right and make sure that we're not living with a bad set of consequences that are impacting students in the classrooms for the next set of years before we have a new law, which is our current situation.
Well, and we should talk about the next iteration and what the Obama administration is trying to do with No Child Left Behind. But let's take another caller before we do. Alyssa's calling in from Claremont. Hi, Alyssa. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. My son, he entered the school system when he was 5. We had adopted him. And he was severely behind developmentally and with reading and math and every aspect, really. And I'm just, right now he's in the third grade. I'm just amazed at the improvement he has made. He's at grade level now with math, and he's almost at grade level with reading. And from where he came from, it's just amazing how much work the teachers have put in with his IEP, that we're very pleased with the success. And I think it's because of the No Child Left Behind that he is where he's at now.
You feel like No Child Left Behind sort of lit a fire under people and made them doubly committed to serving your son, even though he had disabilities.
Yeah, I feel like his whole school supported him and supported our family and helping him, and just a lot of support went into him. And because of that, he's successful, and he will be successful in life.
Alyssa, thanks a lot for calling in. Sandy, what do you think?
Well, that comment is typical of a lot of families with youngsters with disabilities. And that's why the groups with disabilities are so alarmed at these changes that are being suggested to No Child Left Behind. Now, how a school does, how a school's rated, depends upon them taking seriously the commitments they've made in these plans, in the IEPs, under IDEA, the federal law for students with disabilities. It didn't really matter before. It matters now. And so people are paying attention. And that's why that's a very gratifying story you just heard, one that we hear all across the country. I want to go back to Mark's question, though, on this business of students at the top as well. No Child Left Behind does care specifically about kids with disabilities and low-income youngsters. But Mark Schneider just did a study for Fordham, which people can Google and get, showing under the NAEP. Now, this is not a test you can teach to. This is the national assessment. The top 10% of the students at the top, the most gifted students, have seen an increase as well in their performance over this period of time. So it has not been, it's just not a fact that the students at the top are somehow being neglected or are not doing well. They're doing better, and in some cases by equivalent amounts, as students who are not doing very well. So it's important to get the facts straight. One other point I want to talk about in terms of individualized education, attention to individuals and to students' needs. I really encourage people, you know, we've got all these myths around. You know, people now with the Internet can go on and read Section 1113 of No Child Left Behind and read these interventions and these consequences. And I hope teachers will, because if you read what the law says about what has to be done when there's a problem with a certain subgroup not performing, it is a broad list of steps that can be taken. It's a whole variety of things that teachers can choose from and ought to use their professional judgment to choose from in terms of how you improve a school or how you correct what's not worked. It's a tremendous, maybe it's too great a diversity that the Obama administration is saying there are too many choices.
Well, let's talk about what the Obama administration is doing.
It's constricting, and it's important. And again, with the Internet, people can go read what those choices are on their own in their own computer.
Sure. And, you know, we keep touching on this next iteration and what Obama is doing. And let's just hit that right on the head, all of you. And I think to you first, Allison. So as we said, the Obama administration is giving states waivers concerning NCLB. So what does that mean for a state? Does that mean they can just ignore it or what?
Well, the Obama administration set out sort of a list of things that they want, that they'll allow states to get wiggle room on. For instance, we've talked a lot about the kind of main measurement under NCLB. It's known as adequate yearly progress, or AYP. Those are the achievement targets, the standards that each school needs to hit each year. The Obama administration would basically allow states to kind of craft their own accountability systems and set their own goals as long as those systems, you know, met certain parameters. There's some language in the law that requires states to make sure all of their teachers are highly qualified, which means that they have a bachelor's degree and, you know, are proficient in the subject that they're teaching. The Obama administration will allow states to have some wiggle room on that as long as they can prove that teachers are effective and being evaluated in a certain way. So it's sort of a list of trade-offs. And right now, each states are proposing kind of their individual plans for how they would use this new flexibility. And those plans haven't been approved yet, so we're not really sure exactly how far the Obama administration wants to take the law. But certainly, stay tuned.
Our phone number again is 1-800-892-6477. We're taking your thoughts, questions, and comments on the federal reform education law known as No Child Left Behind. Your thoughts, questions about how it's affected your local schools. Has it been for the better or for the worse? We'd love your opinions. 1-800-892-6477. So, Mary, what's your assessment on how the Obama administration is approaching this, and what are your hopes for what they'll do?
Well, I think we need to remember that at the end of the day, we need to have a new law that is workable for students in the classroom, and that's not the Obama administration's responsibility. It is the United States Congress's responsibility and all that. We have applauded the efforts that the Obama administration has taken in terms of issuing the allowance for waivers and allowing a collaborative process to take place at the state level on the waivers, but we see that as a temporary solution to fixing the overall long-term issue, which is creating a law that focuses on the students who are most in need, but provides some balance between the role of the states and the federal government, supplementing the state and local effort in education.
So that means a whole new law, scrap NCLB, and put something wholly new in place. Is that what you're saying?
Not necessarily wholly new. I mean, then you start getting into the weeds and how much language change. I mean, this is certainly a very vast, comprehensive piece of legislation with a lot of elements in it and a lot of legislative language. But at this point, it's about how do we restore and empower states who have come an enormously long way in their accountability systems over the past 10 years to continue to focus on the students who are most in need, and how do we ensure that there are the federal checks and balances in that plan to ensure that our English language learners, our students in poverty, our students with disabilities are getting the attention that they need from the system.
Sandy, is there a middle ground here, a law that will please everybody or at least most people?
Well, I think, I don't know about that these days. Everybody's so contentious, but I do agree with Mary that we need to try to find common ground. There are some, this law is now 10 years old. It's now 4 years overdue for reauthorization. There are things, as Allison said, that Margaret tried to do, Margaret Spellings tried to do to provide for growth measures, to provide for differentiated consequences so that there would be a recognition that some schools fail a lot and some schools just miss by a little bit. We clearly have to go on to the next level of standards, higher standards. And I think the Obama administration has pointed those things out. And I think Mary put it well. I mean, that we've got to find a way to move on to the next level, but without retreating from the insistence that we look at and do something about, just as that parent talked about so eloquently a moment ago, the disadvantaged youngsters or the youngsters who have special needs. We can never go back on trying to hide them, sweep them under the rug, fail to take action to make sure that they're getting their best chance at an education. So maybe there is some middle ground in there where we can move forward together.
Well, let's take one more. This is Kathy in Campton. Hi, Kathy. Thanks for joining us. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I'm a 26-year veteran of teaching physics in public schools in Connecticut, and I did see a decline in the higher-level student being kind of pushed aside, and they felt it, whether it was, you know, just the way that it was all noticed by them, they felt that they were not, no one cared about them. Everything was focused on the lower achiever. And they, my students used to always complain about it. And so I was always concerned about that. And I'm also concerned that the parent angle is not in this whole piece. I found the kids with parents who really cared about them and their education, you know, did better regardless of race and poverty and that kind of thing.
Well, Kathy, thanks for calling in. And all of you, I think we've addressed the did it achieve, did it give enough attention to the highest level learners or not? But I want to pick up on her point about the parents. And I think I'm going to turn to you again one more time, Sandy Kress. I remember having a friend in Vermont who taught middle school, and she said, look, I've got kids who come who haven't had breakfast. I've got kids who come to my class. You know, I heard a horrible story about a dad who put his kids to bed at 5 o'clock every night because he just couldn't deal with them. So, you know, no homework, you know, no help, no reading, nothing. And then she said, under No Child Left Behind, I'm supposed to fix that. And what do I do? So I'd love to get your thoughts, Sandy, on the parent angle of this, that, you know, teachers are being given children with lots of problems, and yet they're all supposed to meet this standard.
Well, when I was president of the Dallas School Board, we put a Youth and Family Service Center program in place, which attempted to bring all the resources of a community together to help the school with out-of-school problems, with problems that parents confront. Senator Graham from Florida and I talked about that. We just didn't have time to bring that together. It would be terrific in the reauthorization if President Obama and legislative leaders came together and asked, how could we get all the federal resources, state resources, local resources, to help the schools, help teachers, help parents with these problems that exist outside the school. But having said that, and how important that is, there is more that the school can do, like be transparent about data, communicate with parents about how students are doing, say that we're not going to consider it a success unless the lowest income and disadvantaged youngsters are getting their needs met. Focus more on their needs and give them opportunities. So we need to do both, and it is not. I hope it's clear. No one says, no one behind No Child Left Behind, Senator Kennedy, President Bush, no one said it's enough to put this responsibility on the school. But there is responsibility that needs to be there, too.
And real quick, Allison Klein, we keep talking about the reauthorization of NCLB. What's the time frame for that?
Well, it's already overdue. By, as Sandy said earlier, 4 years. It was supposed to be reauthorized back in 2007.
4 years, wow.
Yeah. That's why so many folks are clamoring for changes, and that's part of the reason the Obama administration put their waiver plan through. There are some there's some legislation afoot. The Senate Education Committee passed a bipartisan, although only three Republicans supported it, reauthorization bill last fall. The chairman of the House Education Committee just put forth some draft legislation, and they're sort of taking comments on that now. But given just, it's almost more the, it's not really policy disagreements, it's just the, as much as, you know, how politically charged and poisonous the atmosphere is up on Capitol Hill, folks, you know, are really skeptical that this can get done before the presidential election.
Well, Allison Klein, thank you so much for being here. Sandy Kress, Mary Kusler, thank you all very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Ryan Lassard. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. The Exchange is now on Facebook. Join our page to continue the conversation. I'm Laura Kanoy.